How will our cities function in a post-carbon age? Are green cars really the answer? In October 2009, Vancouver, Canada hosted the conference Gaining Ground, Resilient Cities. In the evening, the Post-Carbon Institute organized a panel with Dr. Bill Reese, co-inventor of the ecological footprint idea, California Green City expert Warren Karlenzig, and author Daniel Lurch. He's the program director at the Institute. From Urban Resilience in a Post-Carbon World, here is Bill Reese, recorded October 20th by Radio EcoShock. Bill is introduced by Daniel Lurch.
So starting with Bill Reese, Bill probably needs no introduction to a Canadian audience of urban thinkers. He's the co-originator of the ecological footprint concept, very widely used, and his classic book on the subject, Our Ecological Footprint, with Malthus Walker-Nagel, is now available throughout the world in 9 languages. Bill's teaching and research really go to the heart of what it means for humans to live sustainably, and that is for human civilization to persist and not consume the planet beyond the point of no return. He's a longtime professor at the School of Community Regional Planning at University of British Columbia, and he's our fellow of Ecology and Resilience at Post Carbon Institute.
Thank you, Daniel, and welcome, everyone. It's wonderful to see so many people out this evening, especially so many friends and folks I've met along the way, and we seem to be gathering together increasingly frequently these days as the seriousness of the situation unfolds. It also means there's only a few of us worried about this, and the other 2 billion people are out there and not bothering to come around. Okay, so I'm going to try to answer some of the questions that Daniel raised, including what we really ought to be thinking about when we talk about resilient cities. By the way, I've been speaking for about 5 hours already today, so my voice is gravelly and may give out partway through. Here is a kind of quasi-formal definition of resilience coined by Buzz Holling, a former professor here at UBC. I guess he's actually speaking in the CANSI conference either tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock or sometime at any rate. He is famous for having established, among other things, the Resilience Alliance, which you can see online, lots of publications, and a famous book, which I'll make reference to in a moment. Resilience in an ecological sense is a measure. It's a measure of the capacity of a system to sustain or to absorb an impact, a perturbation, while still retaining its fundamental structure and function. So we're increasingly realizing that complex systems like economies, ecosystems, and cities have a lot of capacity to absorb change, but you can push them to what's now becoming a buzzword, a tipping point, where they crash into a different domain of stability. So if you think of the North Atlantic cod, a very complex ecosystem in which they were a part, we pushed them, we kept taking more and more fish, and then 1 year, population crashed, we stopped fishing, they haven't gone extinct, but they haven't recovered after 14 or 15 years of no fishing pressure, because the whole structure and function of the ecosystem of which they were a part has shifted and no longer accommodates the former ecological niche of the cod. So that's what we're dealing with. Are we in a situation where our cities are going to be pushed to the point where they cross a tipping point and no longer can maintain their social, political, ecological integrity? Now, I happen to disagree with the view that cities are inherently resilient. They may have some properties of resilience, but I think they are currently vastly more vulnerable than they are resilient. When you think about it, we have in Vancouver about 2.5 million people in this region now. We think we live here, but as I'll show in a moment, in ecological terms, we don't. We're totally dependent on what's happening elsewhere. And the capacity of the city to hold together depends utterly on the maintenance of its multiple linkages to other parts of the world. And those multiple linkages are threatened by peak oil, soil losses elsewhere. You haven't a clue what the state of the soils are that are supporting you. Climate change is a problem, probably the one that most people are familiar with. How about geopolitical instability that is likely to result from the major changes that we see unfolding ahead of us? All of these things threaten the resilience of cities, and we're completely unprepared for the event of those things happening either one at a time or together. So I want to put this in a context then that establishes where we are coming from as a species. We are, like every other organism, to some degree directed by our biological survival instincts. And two of them stick out, and they're really reflected in the growth economy. And the first of these is that human beings, like every other species, have an inherent tendency, it's genetically based, to expand to fill all the available habitat. What organism has the largest geographic range on planet Earth, advanced vertebrate organism? Hint, it's sitting in your seats. Okay. So we're very good at this. If you drop a bacterial cell on a petri dish, within a few days it will spread over, cover the entire dish, and consume all of the nutrients. Humans are no different. The Earth is our petri dish. It's taken us 50,000 years to occupy the entire planet. There is not a heritable or a habitable piece of landscape anywhere that is not now occupied by human beings. The second thing we do is use up all the resources. And if you think of petroleum, it's a perfectly good example. We are now reaching peak oil. The Arctic Ocean is melting. Are we deeply concerned about the implications of that for climate change? Hell no. We're fighting like hell to divide the sea bottom up to get at the oil, which is causing the problem in the first place. So everywhere you look, these two tendencies manifest themselves in human behavior. And they pay off, in a sense, with an obvious indicator of human evolutionary success. Now, I could explain this in terms of something called the maximum power principle, but the basic point is that a successful system is a system that manages to appropriate the maximum amount of energy from its environment and use that to generate itself, to increase its numbers, its scope, and all the rest of it. And humans have had two huge leap forwards in the energy domain. The first was agriculture 10,000 years ago, and the second is just a couple of hundred years old, the discovery of how to use fossil fuel to give us access to everything else. The cod would not be extinct in the absence of fossil fuel. We would not be deforesting the planet in the absence of fossil fuel. We would not be mining the earth in the absence of fossil fuel to nearly the extent that we are. So fossil fuel is really the source of this explosion in human numbers and in the scale of the artifacts of our civilization. And it's only a couple of hundred years old. So that's the first point. This is a manifestation of human evolutionary success that has enabled us to spread right over the planet and to increase our use of all other kinds of resources. The other thing to keep in mind here is that I could have extended that x-axis, you know, right across the city, a couple of million years, it would be absolutely flat. You could barely detect the incoming or the advent of agriculture or anything else in the last 10,000 years. Almost everything has happened in the last few seconds of the day in the life of the human species. So that what we take to be the norm is the single most abnormal period in the history of humankind. Only eight generations of people have experienced enough growth or technological change to notice it in their lifetimes. If you went back just 300 years, you could live to be 100 and not see anything significant change. All of that's now changed. Almost everything that we think of as normal technology didn't exist when I was born. So the pace of change is inordinately rapid and clearly outpaces anything historically. Only two generations of humans, this will surprise some of you, have been alive during a period when growth was actually a part of any government platform. It was only in the 1950s that growth became the official driver, as it were, of almost all government policies around the planet. Yet we take this to be the norm. And again, I want to underscore, it's the single most abnormal period in human history. Now, humans happen to be case strategists. That is to say, and I've already, in a sense, hinted on this, we are a large-bodied, long-lived, slowly reproducing species that always pushes up against the carrying capacity of its environment. That's what Malthus told us. Fossil fuel has greatly increased the carrying capacity, so the human population has exploded take advantage of that, but we're still on that sigmoid growth curve. The red line there indicating the departure from exponential growth It starts to slow down as resources run out or as population pressures feed back. And you can actually see that beginning to happen. There's the exponential phase, but everyone now anticipates the population is going to level out at mid-century just as this levels out. So we're characteristic of a K-strategist species. Now, I want to put this in the context of another idea that is very tightly tied to the resilience notion, and it's called the panarchy cycle. And again, this is a contribution from the Resilience Alliance that Buzz Holling established. It turns out that many natural systems continually recycle through an identifiable pattern time and time again. Holling describes it as a never-ending adaptive cycle of growth, accumulation, restructuring, collapse, and then renewal. And these cycles take place at every scale. If you imagine a leaf buds out, grows, does its thing, falls off. Next year, we see the cycle repeat. Then there's the seasonal cycle for the whole of the ecosystem. We see business cycles. We've just seen a major crash in the economic system. So it doesn't really matter what complex system you look at. You can detect long-term and short-term, large-scale, small-scale cycles of one kind or another. This is the so-called recumbent figure eight diagram that describes them. And again, think of our population as beginning to exploit the planet, rising to a point where it becomes brittle, vulnerable to any kind of perturbation. And when that perturbation comes, the crash happens, resources are released and all the rest of it, and then the system can start over again. If you think about the pine forests of British Columbia, it's exactly the cycle they go through. They grow, there becomes a total mature pine forest. Then what happens? All of the nutrients are bound up in the wood, the soil is pretty crummy, but the forest becomes very vulnerable to a lightning strike, it burns out. But the forest is completely adapted to that because the cones open up when exposed to fire, they then sprout, and the whole cycle begins over again. Now, the problem is that many people are attempting to apply the panarchy cycle to the human concept of resilience, and I want to make the case that in the case of human beings, we differ. We cannot count on repeating this cycle at the grand scale that other systems are able to undertake. And that's for this reason. Human beings consider themselves to be productive. We talk about producing in the economy, increasing resource productivity, and all the rest of it. But the simple reality is that every act of economic production is a much larger act of consumption. When we produce we were talking about this earlier, a cell phone, there may be a ton of material that had to be moved, mined, transformed to get the tiny bit of precious metal that goes into the cell phone. There's 10,000 liters of toxic water produced with the production of this cell phone. I don't know if that's the right number, but it's a large number. The point is that everything we do involves the consumption of a vastly larger quantity of energy and material. And because of this, we are on a different kind of trajectory than other systems that can do the recycling. If we occupy a territory and use up all of the resources and the human system collapses, it rarely recovers on site. So if we look back at the history of human civilizations, there's two books that do this that are fairly recent. One is called The Collapse of Complex Societies by Joseph Tainter. And the other is called Collapse, How Societies Choose to Fail or Succeed. And what you find is when a culture, it may take a few hundred years or 1,000 or 2,000 years, reaches a pinnacle, becomes brittle, corrupt, runs out of resources, no longer can feed itself, it collapses, it doesn't recover in place because it's used up the resource base upon which it originally depended. Now, we live in a global urban society in which we're on that upward trajectory in terms of population and the accumulation of all of our artifacts. In many countries, we have vastly exceeded the carrying capacity of the individual countries, but because of globalization, we don't notice, because we can import stuff from all over the planet, which enables us to sustain ourselves on that trajectory even after having worn out our own local system. I'll talk tomorrow more about this, but half the countries on Earth are vastly in exceedance of their carrying capacity and depend on other countries. One energy analyst, Richard Duncan, argues that we're so dependent on fossil energy for the acquisition of everything else that we're going to go through a cycle that looks like this. We're already on the, obviously, have gotten to about point F in his view. And once we run out of the fossil fuel, all of the alternatives that are currently in the pipe in total don't amount to a hill of beans when compared to the energy content from fossil fuel. And he argues, as do others, that we have no hope of maintaining a civilization of 6 or 7 or 8 billion people on the fossil fuel or alternative energy reserve. Note the curve, which is purely speculative, compared to that of a population of reindeer, very similar to the human situation, reduced or introduced to an island in which was abundant lichens initially. Couple of decades, they eat the whole place out, rise to a population that can no longer sustain itself, and crash it. So this is a common phenomenon in a simplified ecosystem like this one with reindeer and lichen, or humans, which come to be the dominant species. So the question is a growth-based global culture, is it possible that we could actually be selected out? And this is a quote from Painter, "What's most intriguing in the evolution of human societies is the regularity with which the pattern of increasing complexity, of administrative complexity, of social complexity, of economic complexity, is interrupted by collapse, when they reach a point of diminishing returns, when they can no longer sustain themselves." So if we're an urban culture, where every city is dependent on the continued productivity of distant elsewheres, and I must underscore this, we are utterly dependent in Canada as a whole, now for about 60% of our food, on distant elsewhere. By the way, we also export half of our agricultural land. But the point is, every city in particular is utterly dependent on the maintenance of those elsewheres for its sustainability. And yet it has no control over any of the factors that Daniel mentioned at the outset that are important to say. We don't control our energy flows. We don't control our food flows. We don't control where the water comes from, and all of that sort of thing. So I would argue that if you are serious about urban sustainability, we have to reconfigure what we mean by the city. And it should be done on a bioregional model. That is to say, we now have to think about creating a new kind of political jurisdiction. Provinces in Canada, states in the United States, are products of the 19th century. There's not a single mention of cities or communities in the Canadian Constitution, for example. They didn't exist. Everyone was rural. Today, 85% of the population of this country lives in cities. They have no political control, almost no tax-raising powers, no say over any of the resource administration or anything else about the city. When this city wants to do something, it's usually overridden by somebody's dictum in Victoria, for example. Frankly, today we don't even need provinces. What we need is a new kind of urban-centered, ecological city-state which gathers around itself, or which claims for itself, a sufficient territory upon which it can be more or less self-reliant. So I would argue that the qualities of a resilient city boil down to this. Now listen, I'm talking about a world that has to change. And if we're not willing to imagine a completely different structuring of our settlement patterns and the political jurisdictional framing within which they operate, we're really not going anywhere. So we need to start thinking about the appropriate scale of our cities. Is a city like Tokyo, and I'll talk about Tokyo tomorrow, Tokyo has 33 million people. 33 million people, the population of Canada, in a single urban agglomeration, and it requires 2.5 times Japan to sustain itself. So if there is a major climate shift, major geopolitical disruption, you cannot imagine sustaining a megacity on that scale. It will simply not have access to the food, the energy, the water, and the other resources it needs to sustain itself. We might have to write off some of our cities. The U.S. Energy Minister spoke in California earlier this year and said because of water problems, even California might have to think about redistributing its population from cities that have to those that have not. So the resilient city, first of all, has to think about appropriate scale in the context of its ecosystem array. We have to talk about steady state economic planning. Growth is not an option in the world of the future. We need to talk about social equity, because in the absence of growth, we can no longer say that we can relieve poverty by growing the pie bigger. Redistribution becomes a necessary component of the sustainable, resilient city. There has to be an explicit population policy to keep that population below the regional carrying capacity of the city-state. We can't afford to just assume we can keep taking on more people if the bioresource base that sustains them is constantly shrinking, as it is today on a planet-wide basis. The city ought to be a self-governing city-state with control over its own resources. That's an impossible arrangement under the current system of governance in this country. It should be more self-reliant. I don't mean self-sufficient. That's an impossibility. But we need to increase the self-reliance of cities while incorporating these city-states in a network of trading possibilities so that when one gets in crisis, if there is surplus elsewhere, it can be relieved to some degree. But we cannot any longer think that there will always be surplus biocapacity somewhere else to provide our needs. We get half our table vegetables in North America from California, and by mid-century, some authorities think there will be no table vegetable production of significance for export in California. So why should we be paving over our best agricultural land in the vicinity of Vancouver on the assumption we'll always be able to import our necessities from elsewhere? We need to have multiple redundant energy, water, and food sources. The essence of resilience is redundance, not efficiency. It's having a multiple choice so that if one energy system is knocked out, you can fall back on some of the others. It just makes sense. We need multiple sources for our food stocks. We can't depend on those imports from elsewhere all the time. We need highly buffered food and water supplies. I don't know why this has gone off the bottom here. What I'm talking about then is a regional eco-city, and these ideas are not novel. Van der Ren and Calthorpe, Peter Calthorpe, way back in the 80s, talked about something somewhat similar in these terms. Rather than being merely the site of consumption, cities might, through their very design, produce their own food and energy, as well as become the locus of work for their residents. And this goes further back if we talk about Patrick Geddes and Lewis Mumford, Ebenezer Howard. These are some of the great city planners of the 19th and early 20th century who were voicing these ideas already anticipating the fix that we're in today. So we've got to think big about the future of cities if we hope them to survive in the event that the science of climate change and resource scarcity, including peak oil, is true. If it unfolds as the data suggests, the cities that we know today are in for a complete revolution in their structure politically, ecologically, and economically. Thank you.
You have just heard Canadian scholar and author Bill Rees, recorded October 20th, 2009, by Radio EcoShock in Vancouver. This was part of a panel titled Urban Resilience in a Post-Carbon World, presented by the Post-Carbon Institute. For more information, go to postcarbon.org.